Greetings, warriors, veterans, and America-loving citizens from sea to shining sea. Welcome to Frontlines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Hoo-wah! The Frontlines of Freedom team really appreciates you joining us this fine day in America. We are and should be proud Americans. Okay, here's what we have for you this hour. We're going to start by talking with combat veteran Scott Venema. Then Adam Malone will discuss getting America food independent. And General Chris Petty will present the Battle of the Month. Of course, we'll conclude with military history and our self-defense report. So it's a pleasure to introduce my good friend and fellow grunt, Scott Venema. Scott had a number of interesting experiences during his time in Mother Army, so we'll talk about them. Welcome, Scott.
Thank you so much, Denny. I appreciate the opportunity to be here.
Scott, when and why did you join Mother Army? You were enlisted, right?
Yes. I originally enlisted in 1990, and my reasons were very self-interested. I was a college student, really struggling to try to pay for college, working and attending classes. And so after 1 year of struggling through that, I decided to join the Army to take them up on their recruiting offers to help pay for college. And it was, as I said, very selfish. But once I got in, I discovered this real sense of pride and patriotism and altruism that I didn't know I had, and decided at a very early age that I loved it and I was going to stay in as long as I possibly could.
Well, you know, that's really typical in my experience. I haven't ever done any formal recruiting, but I've done a lot of informal recruiting. And I'd say a very high percentage of people who join the military do it, sure, at least for one of the reasons is college money. So I don't think you're atypical at all.
Right. Yeah. And as I said, it was something that it helped me to learn more about myself. And honestly, it helped me to mature quite a bit. So when I did go back to college, I was a totally different person. It really put me in the right frame of mind.
Yeah, it's amazing, particularly at that age level, what a few years of real world can do to your level of comprehension and maturity.
Certainly. It's a good statement.
So you joined the Army, you were enlisted. I know you became an officer. Talk about your time as an enlisted man and when and why and how you moved to become an officer.
Great. So I started off as a medic in the Army, and I did that for about 3 years. And I felt that I really wanted to do something a little more action-oriented. And so I branch transferred into the infantry, and I was in the infantry for another 3 years. And then I had an opportunity to go back to college and get my master's degree. So I used additional Army benefits to help pay for a master's degree. And while I was doing that, I joined ROTC. And so because I was prior service, I only had to do a 2-year program in ROTC. And then I was commissioned in 1998 and went back on active duty at that time as a second lieutenant.
Okay. And I know you were a grunt, infantry. Where did you serve in the infantry? And I presume you were platoon leader and held typical second lieutenant jobs?
I did. Actually, when I was first commissioned, I was a military intelligence officer, but I was assigned to the infantry my entire time. So I felt very fortunate that I got to do something that was a little different from my enlisted experience, but then I was still at home in an infantry battalion. And so I served as a platoon leader and company executive officer, kind of dual slotted, but I only did that for 5 months. And then I was pulled in to be a battalion intelligence officer. Did that for about 2 years, and it was phenomenal. I had a great experience, deployed to the National Training Center 5 times, so I got to see the desert quite a bit. And after that, in 2001, when the terrorist attacks occurred, I made a decision to try to make a change and do something even more action-oriented, and I was fortunate enough to be able to find my way over to the Special Forces environment. And so then I was a brand new captain, and I worked in 10th Special Forces Group, also at Fort Carson. So I was fortunate that my family didn't have to PCS. I was able to make that transition and just go down the street, basically, to another unit.
That makes sense. One aside, I always referred to military intelligence as a contradiction in terms. Did you find that to be the case?
Well, I could tell you that some of the people that I was in that school program with, I would definitely agree to be a contradiction.
But hey, we served. Okay, this is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with Army vet Scott Venema. Okay, Scott, you were assigned to and work with the Green Berets. And you deployed at least twice, didn't you?
Five times, as a matter of fact. Yes. So I was in the initial war when we were fighting against the Iraqi military to bring down the Saddam Hussein regime. And in that role, I was just an additional staff officer, basically. And so without having any true, I would say, responsibilities, the group commander put me in the U.S. Embassy in Turkey before the war started to help try to facilitate our passage through Turkey. And if you recall, back in February of 2003, the Turkish parliament voted against that. And so then we had to adapt. And I was his eyes and ears on the ground within the government of Turkey to try to get the right information. And 10th Group ended up staging out of Romania instead and flew around the Turkish airspace to get into Iraq. And eventually I was able to leave the country of Turkey and join the rest of the group in Erbil, northern Iraq. And then we pushed south and secured the cities of Kirkuk and Mosul and fought a Republican Guard division along our way as we are securing those key pieces of terrain, those key cities, and then turned it over to the 101st and to the 173rd Airborne.
So you got a chance to see the ground over there and duck around a little bit. And I understand, I know that you were injured somehow. Was that where you were injured?
After that first deployment, then I came back to Fort Carson, and I was given command of the military intelligence detachment. So I had human intelligence collectors and interrogators, as well as signal intelligence. They would eavesdrop and then jam signals. And then the third group that I commanded was the analysts who put it all together and then made recommendations. So during that time as a commander of that group, I deployed back to Iraq four additional times and did sustain some injuries over those deployments. And fortunately for me, I was able, when I did depart from the Army, I was able to work with the VA and get a VA-rated disability. And I would say that the level of care initially wasn't so good, but in 2016, it started to improve. And so I would say that the level of care that I've gotten since then has been fantastic.
I understand. I've gotten good care from the VA, though I know some bad stories other people have had.
Sure.
But my experience is all good.
That's great. I've had similar experiences.
Okay, so you got out. What are you doing now?
Well, when I got out, it's kind of funny. I was looking for something that would enable me to stay in Colorado, and I wasn't able to fulfill that goal, but I got into medical sales. And so I've been in medical sales since 2006 when I left active duty Army. And I've worked for a few different companies, and it's been a really wonderful experience. I've been fortunate enough to work with companies that have been military friendly. So there's people that are like-minded in the organizations where I've been fortunate enough to work. And it has been a really good experience for me. And I've been very fortunate to do well and provide for my family. So I'm thankful for those opportunities.
So it sounds like starting with college and then Mother Army and now your current position, you're living a pretty good life.
I have no complaints. And I say all the time that, God has provided for me in ways that I probably don't deserve.
Hey, if we all only got from God what we deserve, we would all be in deep.
You're probably right.
Scott, thank you. Thank you for sharing with us today. Thank you for your service to our nation. Thank you for being a great friend.
I just want to say thank you for everything that you continue to do for veterans. I love the fact that you have this program and that you share your voice and the voices of other veterans and let the rest of the country know how much we love them and how much we sacrifice willingly to make sure that others have a wonderful, stable, and secure and safe life.
Thank you, brother. Next up, we'll talk about food with Adam Lalonde. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. It's time to do some deep knee bends, troops. Go halfway down each time, do about 40. Do this while thinking patriotic thoughts. I'll be right back. Friends, there's not too many things I enjoy more than helping veterans and eating great beef jerky. Now I can do both. My good friends at Tango3.org and America's Best Beef Jerky use the highest quality beef to make the best jerky I've ever tasted. Trust me, I've eaten a lot. But that's not all. They give 100% of the profit to vetted veterans programs, mental health and suicide prevention. Go to americasbestbeefjerky.com and order now. And at checkout, check the Frontlines of Freedom promo code.
The Iraq War is more than 20 years old, and troops are still on the ground in Iraq. But why?
For too long, lawmakers have sent American troops to Iraq and beyond in support of vague missions that don't tie to a vital national interest.
At Concerned Veterans for America, we're translating our unique experiences as veterans to call for a better foreign policy that makes Americans safer and more prosperous.
Visit cvafrontlines.com to learn more and join the movement. That's cvafrontlines.com.
I'm Colonel Danny Gillum. Thanks for joining us today on Frontlines of Freedom. I'm happy to welcome back to the show my friend Adam Lalonde. Adam is a farmer. He raises and sells food. His company is called Patriot Food. At one time, our nation was food independent, but we're not now, and we need to be again. So welcome, Adam. We're brothers in this fight. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, that's for sure, Denny. Great to be on again. Great to be on. Thank you.
How did you become a farmer, Adam? Was that something you just grew up in a farming family? How'd that happen?
Yeah, we're about four-generation farmers, and I grew up in it, and we're in the blueberry business, West Michigan. We farm currently about 700 acres from South Haven to Rothbury, and that's what we do. And I tell you, Denny, we ran into problems back in 2018. The bigger retailer said, you know, Mr. Lalonde, we don't need your blueberries like we needed them in 17. We have Mexico. We have Peruvian berries that are a lot cheaper than yours, sir. So that's what they did. And we got our first taste of that in 18. So we didn't waste any time, and we invested in a new company that is Patriot Foods, as you know. And we are U.S. only food company supporting the U.S. farmer, sounding the alarm how important it is to buy U.S. food, how important it is to read your labels on the store shelf, how important it is to keep our money in this country instead of giving it to everybody else, right? It's so important that we know what we're doing. You know, there's so many companies, big companies, conglomerates, large retail that are selling out the American farmer for a cheaper price out of Mexico and what have you. And then you have the Chinese like hound dogs in a corner waiting for people to give their land away. And I call it ghost LLC companies that the Chinese work through to buy up this land. And, you know, the American citizens don't know it. They don't know it, but the Chinese are coming in our back door, if you will, and they're buying underneath these ghost LLCs, and they're buying up land through ghost LLCs, through hidden LLCs that you wouldn't recognize as a Chinese operative way. So there's a lot of reasons why we do what we do. The biggest reason is we're supporting the small farmer, the 300-acre, 700-acre farmer, as we are. And we're getting the news out, Denny. It's so important. A lot of U.S. citizens don't realize what is going on. And that is a big part of our mission, is to get the word out, tell people what is going on, how bad it really is. You know, that's what we do.
Well, it is really important that our nation be able to feed itself, because at least in America, we know what kinds of water, what kinds of fertilizer and other chemicals are used on this food. We don't know in foreign countries. We don't know anything about that. And should there be a war, or should there be a disease that shuts down other countries, we still need to eat. So to me, the logical thing is we want food that is, if they're animals, they're raised in the United States and the meat's processed here. If it's things, it's grown in the United States and it's processed here, we need it just to protect ourselves. We're in a really weird world situation. We need to be able to feed ourselves and not be dependent on foreign countries raising the stuff and the transportation of the food here and them not getting mad at us or deciding not to feed us.
That's insane. That's right. You know, and it's a bigger problem than most people realize. I tell you, the stuff coming out of Mexico you know, the fruits and vegetables, Denny, are in a controlled atmosphere trailer, okay? You have to keep the temperature at 34 degrees for a berry, right? Just for an example. So customs, you know, they don't want to just rip these back doors open on these trailers, on these semi-trailers, okay? Because you break that temperature, that becomes very costly for the government to search a trailer. So I'm telling you, guys, these vegetables, these fruits, these controlled trailers, controlled temperature trailers are a free ride for the cartel. They're feeding your kids drugs, okay? And they're putting your farmers out of business, and they're feeding you garbage, literally. I tell you, Denny, like you just said, we don't know how they're irrigating these crops. We don't know what they're using. The U.S. farmer, hey, we do things right. You know, we follow the rules. We follow the laws. Food safety is unbelievable in this country, you know? But let me just keep going on this rant a little bit here. And Denny, one of the biggest problems is this with this cheap food. It comes in here. It used to be a seasonal thing for Mexico or Peru or Uruguay or Argentina, right? It used to be seasonal. Now they're coming in year round. And besides that, Denny, the cheap prices on that food creates a market, okay? And the retailer says, no, Adam, no, Patriot Foods. We won't buy your blueberries unless you can be at this price. We can't be at that price, Denny. It's impossible. We're not Mexico, okay? We can't grow cheap like Mexico can, okay? So the problem is this cheap food is creating a market that the retailer is basically putting a gun to the American farmer's head, saying, if you can't meet this foreign market, we can't help you no more, okay? So that's a humongous problem. It's a humongous problem for the ranchers, for the veggie guys. I'm telling you, it's unbelievable. It's changing this country very, very quickly, folks. We have to read our labels, and don't think you don't make a difference. Leave it on the shelf. It's up to us, you know? It's up to us what we do, what we eat, and leave it on the shelves. Shop from us. Shop Patriot Foods. It's all U.S. only. It's all U.S. food. And that's what it's all about, you know? This Patriot Food Store, Denny, is our country store. It's not a Adam store. It's not a Denny store. It's our store. We're keeping our money in this country. We're feeding ourselves from our own food, right? We're supporting our farmers, right? I'm telling you, it's a country store. It's our country's brand. In a nutshell, I just couldn't explain it any better than that.
Well said. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with Adam Malone from Patriot Foods. You know, the issue here is we want our farmers to make a good salary so they can take care of themselves and raise their families and live a good life. If we're paying less for foreign food that has to be transported here, obviously those workers are being paid very darn little and probably living in a pretty lousy environment. Why would we want to support that? We want to support our farmers. And if you tell a store owner or a store manager, gee, I'd be buying more of this, but I want food bought, grown and made in America, that will get through to them. It will, because what else would? But we can't support other countries who pay workers next to nothing. And then, I mean, those workers get paid some little thing. Then they are transported to here and they sell them for cheaper than Adam can grow just down the road. I mean, something's wrong here. And it's something that we Americans need to stand up for.
Yeah, for sure. I tell you, you know, the thing coming out of Mexico, I keep talking about Mexico, but it's a massive problem. You know, the cartels are loading these semis, Denny, and it's no joke. You know, it's been on the news. It's been all over the news. The cartel are loading these trailers, and every third trailer has enough drugs on it to make up for the price they're getting for their produce on the first two trailers, okay? So it doesn't really matter that much to the cartel how much money they're getting for a load of blueberries or a load of tomatoes or a load of peppers or strawberries, what have you. It doesn't really matter. They're making their money on that third trailer with the drugs. And it's a fact. It's horrible what's going on. We all know what's going on with our smart people in Washington right now, right? We don't need to get into that. But folks, we have to take care of ourselves. The government ain't going to take care of you. You know, there's one thing the government's good at doing. And that's nothing at all, guys. We have to take care of ourselves. We have to read our labels. And we have to start buying U.S. only. That's just where we're at. And everybody can make a difference. But this is how it starts.
Amen. Adam, we're about out of time. How can listeners get in touch with you and see what you have to offer at Patriot Foods?
Go to patriotfoods.com. And guys, remember, we are not a survival food company. It's patriotfoods.com. Hey, it's food grown from your dirt. Beef, I'm telling you, pork, Berkshire pork. We have tons of meat, okay? All kinds of vegetables and fruits. Fruits, I'm telling you, it's unbelievable. Almost 500 items now. Patriotfoods.com.
I've been shopping there for over 2 years. I totally agree. It's great stuff. Thank you, Adam, for sharing this important information today. And thank you for your continuing service to our nation.
Thank you, Denny. Thank you so much.
Coming up next on Front Lines of Freedom, General Chris Petty will present the Battle of the Month, and we'll open our weekly mailbag. Troops, I hope you are giving serious thought to buying some gold and silver to keep your future more secure. Check out Universal Coin. That's where I go. UniversalCoin.com/Denny. That's UniversalCoin.com/Denny. This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Front Lines of Freedom. Troops, it's time for one-arm push-ups. Just do a dozen with each arm twice. Then take a break and stay in the area. I'll be right back.
Fresh, flash, frozen from the American farmer every time. PatriotFoods.com, hit the shop now button. You're supporting a veteran family in need every time you shop. Look at us online, see how we give back. For the servicemen and women of this great country, we are fighting for the American farmer. PatriotFoods.com, promo code FREEDOM, 10% off today, folks. Shop now.
This is Colonel Denny Gillum. I buy Patriot Foods. It's great. PatriotFoods.com, promo code FREEDOM.
HealthVet.net was created to be the nation's number one resource center for all veterans, active military, and families. At HealthVet.net, you'll find up-to-date information on benefits available through the VA, resources on education, employment, health and wellness, and more. Find hundreds of nationally recognized organizations offering discounts on products and services, as well as local organizations from attorneys to yoga studios. You'll find them at HealthVet.net. Visit HealthVet.net for all your family's needs.
Welcome back to Front Lines of Freedom. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Troops, I really do welcome your comments and questions. Contact me through frontlinesoffreedom.com or comment on Facebook. And it's time for the Battle of the Month. So, of course, joining us is General Chris Petty. Welcome back, brother.
Always a pleasure, Denny.
Chris, as we do normally, start with a quick review of your time in Mother Army.
Okay. Well, I went to the United States Military Academy like you did, just, you know, a few years later. Commissioned aviation, did all the normal good aviation assignments like a young officer should do. All of a sudden, I find myself deploying to Iraq as a lieutenant colonel commanding a battalion during the surge, which led to some opportunities, which then I'm commanding a brigade and sending units to Afghanistan and Iraq repeatedly, wash, rinse, and repeat. And then all of a sudden, as I'm starting my separation from the Army, I get offered a general officer one-star billet in Bosnia as the NATO commander. And that was a interesting assignment, which, you know, led to some other general officer assignments like working in the Pentagon and the G3, the operations staff, and working in a command at NORTHCOM. So wonderful experience, rewarding, and I recommend it for anyone who is looking to get some direction in their life.
I understand what you're saying, brother. Okay, the battle for this month is the Battle of Little Bighorn. That was quite an interesting battle, wasn't it?
It really was. And one of the reasons we're covering it is because it's such a famous battle, but, you know, a lot of people don't understand some of the details. So I'll try to hit some of the high points as I normally do so people can understand it better.
Okay. Take us there, bro.
Okay. So this is part of the overall Indian Wars, which really, depending on how you define it, can go back to the, you know, to the settlers in early America before we were America. But anyway, this is really part of the Great Sioux War. But the battle itself was 25 to 26 June of 1876. And this is Lieutenant Colonel George Custer, commander of the 7th Cavalry Regiment, versus Sitting Bull, Crazy Horse, and Chief Gall. This is an alliance of Sioux, Cheyenne, and Arapaho. Now, why should we know this battle? Well, as I alluded to, this is really part of our cultural heritage. This is a famous battle that Americans should just know, because it's Little Bighorn. This is Custer's last stand. And that's a good reason by itself to know it. But it was also a defining moment in the Indian Wars and really kind of hardened U.S. resolve, like a mini Pearl Harbor of the day, you know, saying, okay, let's end this thing and let's make these Indians do what they're supposed to do with these treaties that we've signed. That's a whole another story that we're not going to go into about the fairness to the Indians. That's not the point. So here's the summary. You ready?
Go for it.
Okay. So there's a treaty signed. It's called the Fort Laramie Treaty in 1868, which confined the Northern Plains Indians to the Great Sioux Reservation in the Dakota Territory. So picture South Dakota, the western side of South Dakota, essentially as a big Indian reservation. But large bands of Indians were disregarding the treaty. Remember, they didn't really have a concept of like personal property and boundaries and stuff. And they were ranging outside the reservation for hunting and everything. And in fairness to them, part of it was a response to white settlers coming into the Black Hills because gold had been discovered. So it was a reaction to that. But the U.S. Army's Department of the Missouri was in charge of compliance. So the commander put together a task force, and Brigadier General Alfred Terry, who was really the overall commander of this campaign to round up these Indians and force them back onto the reservation. So Terry's put in charge of this operation in the spring of 1876. Now, Terry's plan is to use three columns with about 2,500 total men. He's going to converge from three different directions on the general area where they believe the Indian encampments are, and he's going to drive the Indians back to the reservation. So Colonel John Gibbon leads one column from the west out of Bozeman, current day Bozeman, Montana. Brigadier General George Crook leads a column from the south from Fort Fetterman in Wyoming Territory. And General Terry leads the third column from Bismarck, from the east, with Custer as his primary, you know, subordinate force. So Crook's column from the south gets stopped at the Battle of the Rosebud, and he never links up with the other columns. That's on 17 June. The other columns link up on the 21st on the Yellowstone River. Terry sends Custer south to kind of scoop up the Indians and drive them north while he and Gibbons proceed west, then south. So he's kind of using this hammer anvil concept, which Custer will use this, you know, in the tactics of the battle. So Custer moves aggressively south to make contact. On the 24th, he sends his scouts to spot where the Indians are because he knows he's getting close, and they spot a very large concentration of Indians. Custer moves forward that evening. He's worried he might lose the element of surprise, which has always been a big thing for Custer in the Indian fights he's been in. So he moves up his attack by one day. He doesn't wait for any other columns because he wants the element of surprise. So Custer plans his attack with tactics that have worked well for him in several Indian battles that he's fought. He divides his force into three elements. Major Reno is going to lead the main attack kind of up the river valley. So picture this river valley running from the southeast to the northwest. So Reno's going to drive up the river valley. He sends Captain Benteen south to kind of cut off any escape to the south. And Custer's going to move around to the north and become his own anvil for Reno being the hammer to drive the Indians into him. So that's his plan. Now, Reno, as he drives up the Little Bighorn Creek, he hits a hornet's nest. I mean, he hits a camp that is gigantic, and they weren't on the move. So the Indians had to defend the camp. And they were not going to take it sitting down. They were just literally a hornet's nest. And they came flying after Reno, who had about 150 troopers. And he gets pushed back quickly. And he forms a hasty defense and fights for his life. Now, Custer, who's moving around to the north, once Reno's pinned down, Custer now starts taking the brunt of the fight because all the Indians can now move north and take on Custer. Benteen, who is south, moves to the sound of the guns. He links up with Reno and consolidates in this defensive position, which ends up holding desperately. Custer sent a message to Benteen to move up, but Benteen just couldn't comply. I mean, he just, during the investigation, he just said, I couldn't comply. I was pinned down. So now the details of Custer on the north being attacked by the Indians aren't clear because there were no survivors. But it was apparently by the forensic evidence and the archaeological evidence, there was a running battle with his troopers. He had five companies, about 200 troopers. And it was a running battle before they kind of did their last stand with about 50 troopers on a hilltop where they were just massacred. Now, Reno and Benteen did manage to hold out in their hasty defense until dusk the following day. This is the 26th. And then Terry and Gibbon arrived the following day, and the Indian camp had already moved on. So that was it in a nutshell. I mean, it was a disaster. The 7th Cav lost 268 dead, 55 severely wounded out of 700 total. So it was really a disaster. And, you know, one of the big lessons is, you know, a lot of people criticize Custer in this one for being like vainglorious and seeking a quick win for his ego. You can look at it that way. And I think there's a lot of blame there. But I, as a military guy, I look at his, you know, he did want the element of surprise. And, you know, his biggest problem was he didn't confirm the size of the enemy. His scouts said it was large, and he never took the time to confirm the size of the force he was faced against. And that led to every other problem that he faced that day, dividing his forces, etc. So that was my big lesson out of this thing. So that was the Battle of Little Bighorn in a nutshell for you.
And it would have been better if he had drones, right?
If he had what?
Drones.
Yeah, it'd be a lot better if he had drones. Interesting, interesting you bring up that if he would have had thing, because famously he refused the Gatling gun. You know, the technology existed. He had the ability to pull a Gatling gun behind a horse. That would have obviously drastically increased his firepower. But he didn't want it because it deprived him of mobility. You know, he made that trade-off, which in hindsight was a disaster, but he made it.
Well, yeah. And we all have to live with the consequences of our choices.
We sure do.
This is Colonel Denny Gillum on Frontlines of Freedom. We're talking with General Chris Petty. We just discussed the Battle of Little Bighorn. Chris, take a minute and talk about Battle Digest. We've got just a minute left.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of your listeners know what I do is I publish military history summaries, beautiful trifold brochures with about 3,000 words and a bunch of nice pictures and maps. And they're all available on battledigest.com. I really encourage your listeners to take a look at that website, battledigest.com.
It's a great option if you want to learn more about our nation's battles. And frankly, you don't know what you don't know until you study.
It's true.
Thank you, Chris, for your great review of this well-known but little-known about battle. And thanks for being a member of the Frontlines of Freedom team. I appreciate you.
It is always my pleasure, Denny. I look forward to doing it next month.
This is Colonel Denny Gillum. Coming up, we'll do military history and the self-defense report. You're reporting it's your duty to Frontlines of Freedom, folks. Talk to you soon. Silver has increased 24% over the past 15 months and is a solid financial investment. Silver is projected to continue its rise and is nowhere near its 2011 high of $49 an ounce. So there's still a lot of room for investment growth. Call 800-UCB-GOLD or go to their website at universalcoin.com/Denny. That's universalcoin.com/Denny. I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. This is the final formation for this week on Frontlines of Freedom. You know, I do a bit of coin collecting. Universal Coin is the dealer of the year for the American Numismatic Association. It's a great place to go for coins and a really great place to go for purchase silver and gold. That's what I do. Go to universalcoin.com/Denny. That's universalcoin.com/Denny. Okay, team, it's mailbag time. I really welcome comments from you, our listeners. Do send your thoughts to me at denny@frontlinesoffreedom.com. We're on Facebook. What's the first one, Skip?
Well, Colonel Peter, a National Guardsman, learned a lot about Ukraine. What a good interview.
Thanks, Peter. I knew a lot about Ukraine before I read his book, and I learned a whole lot more. I understand you're appreciating it.
And Roger, an Army vet, really enjoyed the comments by the rabbi about Israel and their war. I stand with Israel, he says.
Roger, I too stand with Israel. And now it's time for military history. Take us there, Skip.
Well, Colonel, on 29 March 1865, the final campaign of the Civil War began in Virginia when Union troops of General Ulysses Grant moved against the Confederate trenches around Petersburg. General Robert Lee's outnumbered rebels were soon forced to evacuate the city and begin a desperate race west. Time was running out for Lee, though. His army was dwindling in size to about 55,000, while Grant's continued to grow. He now had over 125,000 men. On 25 March, Lee attempted to split the Union lines when he attacked Fort Stedman, a stronghold along the Yankee trenches. His army was beaten back, and he lost nearly 5,000 men. Grant seized the initiative, sending 12,000 men past the Confederates' left flank and threatening to cut Lee's escape route from Petersburg. Fighting broke out there. Lee's men could not arrest the federal advance. 2 days later, the Yankees struck at Five Forks, soundly defeating the rebels and leaving Lee no alternative. He pulled his forces from their trenches and raced west, followed by Grant. It was a race that even the great Lee could not win. He surrendered his army on 9 April at Appomattox Courthouse.
Yes, he did. On the 26th of March, 1941, during World War II, Italy attacked the British fleet at Ceuta Bay, Crete, using a detachable warheads to sink a British cruiser. This was the first time manned torpedoes had been employed in naval warfare, adding a new weapon to the world's navy's arsenals. The manned torpedo, known as the Chariot, was unique, primarily used to attack enemy ships still in the harbor. The Chariots needed pilots to drive them to their targets. Sitting astride the torpedo or in a vehicle that would transport them both, the pilot would guide the missile as close to the target as possible, then ride the vehicle back, usually to a submarine. The Chariot was an enormous advantage because its development, the closest weapon to the Chariot, was the Japanese Kitten, a human torpedo or suicide bomb, which had obvious drawbacks. The manned torpedo proved to be the most effective weapon on the Italian Navy arsenal. Italian torpedoes sank the British warships Queen Elizabeth and Valiant, as well as one tanker. They were also used against merchant ships at Gibraltar and elsewhere.
I'm not sure I'd want to do that, Colonel. What about you?
No, you wouldn't see on me the volunteer list.
Okay. And on 27 March 1945, during World War II, in a last-ditch effort to deploy their remaining V-2 missiles against the Allies, the Germans launched their long-range rockets from their only remaining launch site in the Netherlands. Almost 200 civilians in England and Belgium were killed. German scientists had been working on the development of a long-range missile since the 1930s. On 3 October 1942, victory was achieved with a successful trial launch of the V-2, a 12-ton rocket capable of carrying a 1-ton warhead. The missile, fired from an island off Germany's Baltic coast, traveled 118 miles in that first test. By the end of the war, over 2,700 Britons had died because of the rocket attacks, plus another 4,483 deaths in Belgium. After the war, both the U.S. and the Soviet Union captured samples of the rockets for reproduction. Having proved so extraordinarily deadly during the war, the V-2 became the precursor of the intercontinental ballistic missiles of the post-war era.
If you wonder where they came from, now we know. On the 29th of March, 1973, 2 months after the signing of the Vietnam Peace Agreement, the last U.S. combat troops left South Vietnam as Hanoi freed the remaining American prisoners of war held in North Vietnam. America's direct 8-year intervention in the Vietnam War was at an end. In Saigon, some 7,000 Department of Defense civilian employees remained behind to aid South Vietnam in conducting what looked to be a fierce ongoing war with communist North Vietnam. On 30 April 1975, the last few Americans still in South Vietnam were airlifted out of the country as Saigon fell to the communist North. North Vietnamese Colonel Bull Tin accepted the surrender of South Vietnam, and later in the day he remarked, quote, "You have nothing to fear. Between Vietnamese, there are no victims and no vanquished. Only the Americans have been defeated," end quote. The Vietnam War was the longest and most unpopular foreign war in U.S. history, and it cost 58,000 American lives. As many as 2 million Vietnamese soldiers and civilians were killed during the period. Many more South Vietnamese were killed by the victorious North Vietnamese as a punishment for opposing them.
And on 25 March 1994, at the end of a largely unsuccessful 15-month mission, the last U.S. troops departed Somalia, leaving 20,000 U.N. troops behind to keep the peace and facilitate nation-building in the divided country. In 1992, civil war, clan-based fighting, and the worst African drought of the century created famine conditions that threatened 1/4 of Somalia's population with starvation. In August 1992, the UN began a peacekeeping mission there to ensure the distribution of food and medical aid. On December 4, with deteriorating security and UN troops unable to control Somalia's warring factions, President George Bush ordered 25,000 U.S. troops into Somalia. Although he promised the troops involved that the humanitarian mission was not an open-ended commitment, Operation Restore Hope remained unresolved when Bill Clinton took over the presidency in January 1993.
And that's military history for today. And now it's time for our self-defense report. Take us there, bro.
All of us here at Frontlines of Freedom believe strongly in your right to keep and bear arms for protection of yourself and your family. All across the country, violent crime is skyrocketing, and now, more than ever, Americans need to stand up and exercise their Second Amendment rights. Now is the time to get trained and ready to handle this growing threat. But if you're not, please look into it and learn what you can do to legally carry a firearm to protect the ones you love. What's the story this week, Colonel?
Well, scores of thugs swarmed two Memphis gas stations, stealing thousands of dollars of merchandise and destroying property. Looters also hit a 53-foot FedEx semi-trailer, stealing multiple packages. Roughly $2,000 worth of items were stolen from the Exxon station. Over $15,000 of merchandise was taken from the Fill and Go gas station just hours later, when a clerk reported having a rifle pointed at him by a suspect. The mob is estimated to have inflicted $9,000 in damage at the second station. Clerks and paying customers looked on in disbelief as the looters pilfered without any fear of consequence. The entire event was captured on video. No arrests were made.
Thanks, Colonel. Scenes like this are becoming more and more prevalent as the rule of law breaks down in America, and I see no sign of things getting better. After all, when crime pays, then more people will commit crimes. That's common sense. Our criminal justice system is breaking down so criminals aren't punished for their actions. The hands of our police have been tied because they're encouraged or ordered to not uphold the law. And then there's the whole defund the police movement. But once again, my job isn't to preach about the reason why. My job is to give you sound tactical advice that will help you and your loved ones survive an altercation like this. So here we go. First, stay out of the blue-run cities. Leftists are soft on crime, therefore, crime is highest there. Almost every crime-ridden city is governed by Democrats, so if you live there, move. If you can't move, then campaign to replace soft-on-crime politicians with candidates who will bring back the rule of law. Second, stay alert. When you see a group of teens coming into the building, then you need to find a safe way out. When you walk into any building, always check out the secondary escape routes. Always have a plan of escape. If you can't escape, then lock yourself in a bathroom or a storage room. Third, many times these flash mobs turn violent. Sometimes they shoot or stab people. Sometimes they beat people who try to interfere. I know it doesn't sound manly, but let them steal the candy bars. Here's the conundrum. If you try to stop them, then they'll turn on you and you'll be forced to use deadly force just to stay alive. You'd be totally justified in doing so. But in these Democrat-run cities, you could likely be charged with murder and convicted by a brain-dead jury. Things like this anger me and make me want to stand up for what is right. The Marine part of me wants to grab the nearest kid and give him a lecture on right and wrong. But that would only get me hurt or killed, or I'd be forced to kill a stupid, misguided teenager. In the present political climate, the best tactic is to fall back and take video if you can safely do so, and then hand it over to the police. This is a cultural problem that's not going away anytime soon. Be wise and pick only the battles you can win. Frontlines of Freedom encourages you to keep a clear head as society continues to fall apart in our once great cities. God bless, and please stay safe out there.
I wish you didn't have to say those, Kip, but the words you just said were right on, brother. Thank you. Our movie of the month is No Arbor. You can go to the Frontlines of Freedom website, go to the blog and get the link and watch it for free. I'd appreciate getting your comments about the movie. Send them to me at denny@frontlinesoffreedom.com. Next week on Frontlines of Freedom, Vietnam Veterans of America President Jack McManus will discuss Vietnam. Army vet Richard Seabee will discuss the Second Amendment. And Diane Raver from the Garden State Film Festival will discuss the movie of the month. Our book, Frontlines of Freedom, with 19 authors, has the mission of helping all patriotic Americans step up and help our nation return to our traditional values of serving, not being served, of being in shape physically, mentally, and morally, of being proud of our nation. And now it's available in Spanish. You can purchase this book on frontlinesoffreedom.com or Amazon. Please help us get this call to action book into the hands of all Americans. And do get active in correcting our nation. You can plug into Concerned Veterans for America. Go to cvafrontlines.com. That's cvafrontlines.com.
Thank you, friends, for joining us for Frontlines of Freedom today and every week on this great station. Please check us out on Facebook and add your comments. And if you missed any part of this show, hey, all our shows are available on demand at frontlinesoffreedom.com. We especially thank our military listeners for serving our country with honor and dignity and for keeping us all safe. God bless you and your families as you serve.
I'm Colonel Denny Gillum. Thank you, listeners all across America, for joining us in the foxholes on the front lines of freedom. Stand tall, be proud Americans, and join me next week for military and veteran information you will not get anywhere else on the front lines of freedom. Dismissed.